What I've always loved about style is the subjectivity of it, that it means different things to different people. It has more to do with the way we move through the world than it does with the clothes that we wear. Ultimately, it's about passion and attitude. I've spent decades working in fashion's trenches, seen the best and the worst of human style, and have had the chance to get up close and personal with some of the world's most iconic and intriguing characters. I'm Jeannie Becker, and this is Beyond Style Matters. On today's episode, Brad Goreski.
I think my Canadian-ness has served me very well because it has, there's just something people will always say once they find out I'm Canadian, oh, that's why you're so nice. Or I was always wondering, well, how you could always be so nice and so calm and so easy to work with.
Something that really makes my heart sing is seeing how fashion television inspired so many kids to break out of their little hometowns and go off to chase their high glam dreams. LA-based celebrity stylist Brad Goreski is one such Canadian kid. Brad grew up in Port Perry, Ontario, and was obsessed with our fashion television show. In his 2012 autobiography, Born to be Brad, he talks about me reporting from the international shows with such intensity as if I was a war correspondent reporting from the front lines. I cried when Brad showed me that passage in his book, instantly realizing how much he'd been affected by my blatant passion for the fashion scene. Brad's own passion led him to New York, where he interned for Vogue, and eventually LA, where he became a TV darling, first on the Rachel Zoe Project, and then on his own series, It's a Brad World. A stylist to some of Tinseltown's hottest celebs, Brad also co-hosted E! Network's Fashion Police and Live from the Red Carpet. His podcast, Brad Behavior, and his hilarious antics on Instagram and TikTok have earned him a mega following of fashion enthusiasts who crave substance far beyond mere style. And for me personally, he's become emblematic of dreams realized, what it is to choose a creative path and follow it with all your heart. In 2016, when I was proudly inducted into Canada's Walk of Fame, I chose Brad Goreski to introduce me on stage. And it felt pretty fabulous. His dream had come full circle. So Brad, for so long, I know you grew up a little guy in Port Perry watching fashion television. And, you know, there I was in the trenches and you were soaking it all in. You obviously learned a lot, taught yourself so much about fashion, went out there and became this fashion icon.
Oh,
and now here I am, like, interviewing you. Wow.
Well, yeah, the feelings is totally mutual. I'm like, wow, here I am with Jeannie Becker. Mm-hmm. I actually just had Jay Manuel on my podcast, and we talked about you for a while because your influence on all of us that are Canadian and also obviously from other places, but you know, the Canadian kids that ended up leaving or staying and getting into fashion and are of a, you know, a certain age group, we all have you as a common link, as the person that, you know, taught us everything we know. So you were our springboard that anything was possible and that we could make our way in the world of fashion. And you also armed us with, you know, knowledge, like so much knowledge. So I'm so grateful to you, as you know.
And so much of what I learned along the way was just totally by osmosis, because I got into the business as a fashion reporter, just as this kid who had grown up in the 60s loving fashion, and I'd done this rock and roll show, so I knew what it was like to shove my microphone into the faces of big egos and, you know, get the great sound bites. And I learned so much as I went along. It was incredible. Yeah, I guess for me, there weren't really any mentors of that nature to go by. I mean, sure, I used to read, you know, Vogue magazine back in the day, but I wasn't, you know, really intimately familiar with the editors or their their points of view, or I didn't even realize, you know, what the designers were really so amazingly fabulous at. It was just something about the visuals of the magazine that really grabbed me, and the chat about the hip stuff going on that stimulated me. But yeah, I guess I never really had anyone that I could look to like that. So that, for you to be saying that to me, that really means a lot. And I just love you to pieces. I remember the first time I met you, I didn't really know who you were, but you were pointed out to me by my field producer. I had a wonderful field producer by the name of Christopher Sherman at the time. We were at New York Fashion Week, and he said, "Oh, that's Brad Gresson. You got to talk to him. He's so fabulous. He's incredible. He's this great stylist. He's so cool." And it was like, oh, okay. And I just, you know, walked up to you, and I just thought you were the coolest, chicest, you know, most stylish young man I had seen.
Oh, I couldn't believe, I remember
time.
That. I couldn't believe that was happening. And then we did a sit down in Toronto, not too long after that, probably, you know, I think it was probably through Rachel Zoe by then, and had been out on my own. I think it was for E-Talk maybe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I remember that. I remember texting my mom and being like, I just talked to Jeannie Becker.
That's incredible. Anyway, you've come a long way, baby. We have come a long way. The scene, fashion has come a long way, and kind of went into this weird space, I think, right now, where fashion is, it certainly ain't like it used to be.
No.
The fashion scene that you got so excited about, and I was so excited about, and you delved into and really pushed and stretched and provided us with so much entertainment and good taste for all the red carpet dressing you did all those years. I mean, how do you see it now? Fashion and its allure, or perhaps lack of allure. I mean, has it lost its luster a little bit for you?
For me personally, no. I've enjoyed is probably the wrong word, but I think maybe the break of the hectic nature of the fashion world right now has been kind of nice. I think, you know, being a stylist and having so many events and shoots and things going on all at once, it's really made me appreciate my job as a creative outlet that I really enjoy. I did a virtual shoot with a client of mine for Vogue.com, and it was just so nice to be with, like, looking at clothes again, you know, and seeing what's happening. And I do think that we are in a space where things are definitely going to change after this, because there's no way they can't. You know, a lot of designers are not going to be able to survive COVID and this pandemic. Sure. And a lot of big department stores and big brands are also not going to be able to survive. But I think it's also what I'm seeing too in the resort collections and the way that the designers are presenting or had presented their couture collections this season. I think it's also a really good time for people to be tapping into their creativity and pivoting, because we're all having to pivot right now. But I love what I do. I love being around clothes. I love, you know, the joy that fashion, I see fashion bringing to people and to my clients. And I like being the conduit to that. I like making that experience for people.
When you say that you believe that fashion is inevitably going to change, has changed already, and will continue to change, in what way primarily? I mean, is it going to have to do with our appetites for fashion and our zest for great style? I mean, that I think is something that's just inherent in you know, human beings. Mm-hmm. I think fashion is just something that we're the only animals that like to dress up or that get to dress up. So that is it's a very unique thing to us. But how do you think what's gone on in these last few months is really going to change our appetite for it?
Well, what it's made me realize is how much thought I put into the presentation of myself for other people. You know, so being at home right now, and being with my husband, like, you know, I've been dressing down like a lot. And I still have the desire to buy things and to treat myself to things. And, you know, once everything started picking back up, I was, you know, shopping on my sites like I was before. But there has been that moment for me where I'm like, really, where am I wearing this? Like, really, where am I going? I know I want this leopard print Stella McCartney suit, but where am I going in the next year? And so for me, I think it's made me realize that the art of presentation and the way that I take care of myself is very much for an audience. It's not necessarily something that I do when I don't have the audience. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So totally. So that kind of that idea of putting oneself together for other people to see and enjoy and comment on has been taken away for the moment. Mm-hmm. But I think as soon as that's, you know, as soon as that comes back into play, people are going to be out there, I'm hoping, are going to be out there kind of like really ready to like live and have fun. And, you know, I don't know about how much we're going to be showing off though. Like, I wonder how much of the red carpet is going to come back to the way that it was, you know, with $30 million necklaces and, you know, $250,000 gowns. And the other side of that coin is that if we stop supporting the people who are making those gowns and the couturiers and, you know, the women and men at the Lesage embroidery house and the people who make the couture textiles and all of those things, then we also stop a part of fashion history that we really need to keep alive.
Truly.
So it's a big cycle that we all participate in, mm-hmm. right? And so I hope that we can still keep it going together, but I do think people are going to be more conscientious about it.
Yeah, but without question, I remember, you know, after the recession, like in even in 2000, it started to be, you know, not politically correct to strut it too much. You didn't want right. to flaunt it too much. And we went into this kind of minimalism almost yet again. So that could very well be the way, you know, just getting up, because there was so much excess. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was much too much. I mean, you must admit it got kind of obscene, the amount of labels that were out there. And, you know, I hate to say it because, God, so many labels now have suffered. This pandemic has been the nail in the coffin for so many fashion businesses. But I do believe that the cream usually does rise to the top, or I'd like to believe that. And this is just a way of, you know, doing away with just too much excess.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There was an article on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, like I think 2 weeks ago, about how there are brands that were, you know, one is Entire World, who is Scott Sternberg's brand, who did Band of Outsiders for many years. And then that, you know, unfortunately, that brand folded due to investor problems, et cetera. But he's had this brand, Entire World, that he makes in Los Angeles, and it's all basics. And it was basically like kind of on the brink of folding. And then because of the switch into people's desire to have like nice loungewear and comfy clothes to be in, he's getting kind of a second chance at this business. So, you know, I think everything ebbs and flows. And right now, you know, people are still consuming, which I think is great. And it's just different. You know, we're dressing up for Zoom. We're dressing, you know, it's my Jennifer Fisher, the jewelry designer, is a friend of mine. And we were talking the other night and she's like, business is great. Everybody wants a Zoom hoop, you know? So it's like shoulders up, you know, if you're making great tops and great accessories, you're doing fantastic.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting? This shoulder detail is one of the big trends this season, you know, like brow, those pointed, powerful shoulders.
Totally.
So interesting. But you are such a wonderful social media baby. You really get it. You love it. You are so entertaining with your social media. I mean, anyone that follows you on Instagram can delight. Your TikToks are just like off the map, crazy, nutty. Like, you know, if you want to smile, you just have to go to, you know, Brad's Instagram and you're just going to lap it up. Why is that such a great outlet for you? What thrill does that give you personally to be performing to that degree?
Well, it's funny because my mom and I were talking about this. When I was a kid, I used to, with my cousin who lived next door, we would work on shows and throw them in our basement and then invite our aunts and uncles over to come and like watch the show. And there was, it was always like, obviously costumes and dancing and, you know, all we did all kinds of like weird things together. And we would set up like a little theater downstairs and now in the basement. And now, especially during this time, I've needed it as a creative outlet. And I like, part of the reason why I love doing the television work so much is I like to make people laugh. I like to entertain. I like to make people feel good. And Instagram and TikTok have been a great outlet for me because A, they give me a creative project to work on and, you know, for a few hours. And B, it's so many people have DM'd me and have commented saying, you know, that they're going through a tough time and it made them laugh. Or, you know, there are a lot of people going through a lot of things right now. And if my small contribution can be for the person who's, you know, going through something, whatever they might be going through, and it's a little pick-me-up for them, that to me is a great use of social media. Mm. And it's just been, it's just been fun to kind of, I do the Housewives lip syncs that I've been doing. I love those franchises. I watch a lot of Bravo. I was on Bravo for years. And it's just kind of my, like, it's also kind of a way for me to thank the people who are entertaining me right now, you know, because I look forward to my Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays and watching my shows on Bravo. So it was just kind of like a way to be, to celebrate the people that I feel like have been really getting me and Gary through this time.
The role of influencers, you know, and that was like such a major deal for so long now. Do you think that's going to be waning at all in the future?
I don't actually. I think right now, because everything has moved inside and, you know, we're seeing magazines, I believe it was GQ with Rob Pattinson, who did his own photography, and there are a lot of those, my client who shot all of her, well, she had a friend of hers shoot the photos of her, but there's this kind of self-produced advertising happening. And I think influencers, we thought the bubble was going to burst, but I think now they're going to be a lot of, if you're putting out interesting content, I think that brands are very much looking towards these people who have an audience in social media to help keep their brands out there in the universe. So I actually was wondering at the beginning of all of this, I thought, oh no, this is going to be, you know, influencers are going to go bye-bye. But I wonder though, I think in like a practical way, like online, I think that service is going to really continue. I wonder in the fashion space how much it's going to, you know, how many influencers there's going to be in front rows of shows, what shows look like anymore. If we're going to be, you know, I've been lucky to be flown to Paris to shows and all over the place. And I'm just wondering, does that happen anymore? You know, what does that look like? Yeah. But the influencer, I definitely think is here to stay. I don't know if necessarily the ones with 20 million followers are going to be the ones that people are looking to. Because I do think that when I've been working with brands, they now want some sort of more interesting content than just you with a photo holding. They want something that they want to see that you're producing something that is worth. They'll pay you for it, but they want you to do something a little bit more than just take a picture of yourself.
Yeah, than just look hot in an outfit.
Yeah.
But you have always looked hot in outfits. And I don't know when that really, really started for you. I mean, you obviously have learned so much just by osmosis in the world that you threw yourself into. Mm. But when did that real penchant for great style and sartorial savvy. When did that all really start for you, Brad?
Well, I think it's like what you were saying earlier about, you know, if we're as humans, we have this desire, but if you're somebody that loves fashion, like it's always, you're always going to be consuming in some sort of way. I was literally like this since I was a kid, and that's no joke. I didn't have access like we have now to clothing and to designer brands. I would have been a nightmare. Like my poor mother was trying to get me, you know, Benetton and Ralph Lauren and Esprit and all of those things. I was very aware of what brands were cute and what my style was. Like in third grade, I went through kind of like a Wall Street phase. Like I was always doing these things that were, I would see like an image from a movie poster or, you know, a trailer on TV or a movie that I had seen. And those images would just like stay like locked in my brain and I would have to recreate them. So I was in third grade, like slicking my hair, wearing pleated pants and penny loafers. And I had seen it, you know, I'd seen Michael Douglas like with slick hair on the Wall Street poster. I never really dressed like him, but one of the movie characters that had such a big impact on me was Ducky from Pretty in Pink, John Cryer. Those 80s kinds of looks really, especially when it was guys that were doing something, really stayed with me. But I was always doing something, you know, coming up with something. Once I discovered a glue gun, I was gluing sequins to things. I went through a big rave phase. So I was vintage shopping and, you know, going to Kensington Market and by the pound, the Goodwill by the pound. My parents hated it when I went there because I would buy, you know, garbage bags filled with clothing that, you know, wasn't really washed. And I'd bring them back to Port Perry from Toronto. And my dad would just be like, oh my God, like just get this stuff in the washing machine now. Mm. But I, you know, I went to a high school too, where people weren't, you know, we call them the headbangers. We had the headbangers who were the people who liked like Metallica and all of the metal bands. Then we had the jocks. And then I was with the freaks and we, you know, I would make my own pants with like funny materials. Like I was just, you know, my parents, thank God, were very accepting of all of my different looks. And regardless of how much I was yelled at and bullied and stuff, like I didn't really ever change my tune that much. You know, I hit a little bit more, but I didn't really I didn't change my tune very much. And I don't know where that fearlessness came from.
And you were bullied. Like
yeah.
People were mean to you, called
you
names.
Oh God, yeah, horrible. Every day. It was so bad to the point that I didn't want to go to my high school graduation. My mom basically, and my dad were both like, you'll be really sorry if you didn't go, but I didn't want to go and get my diploma and have people screaming at me from the audience. So mm-hmm. I went and I did it and I left and I graduated early and then, you know, but that stuff stays with you for like your entire life.
Was there a moment in your career, in your life post high school, you know, when you finally made it to the big city and things started happening for you that you really said, you know what, screw you, I've made it, you know, haha, so there. I mean, I always felt that too growing up. There was that was part of my drive. You know, kids made fun of me for, wow, you're taking me back. This stuff I haven't really thought about in a long time. But I used to wear a lot of hand-me-downs because we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And we had these rich cousins in Passaic, New Jersey that used to send us boxes full of used clothing. And I would, you know, strut them proudly because they were great party dresses. Some of the stuff was probably inappropriate to wear to school, but I wore it. And I remember one creepy guy once said to me, oh, that looks like something that came out of a Salvation Army barrel or something. And I was just mortified. So, you know, I mean, and all those people all through your life that tell you you're not good enough, you're never going to make it. You know, I remember when I was working in radio in St. John's, Newfoundland, there was a producer there that said, you belong in the theater, maybe, definitely not in radio. You'll never make it in media. You're way too out there. You're way too theatrical. Your voice is so irritating. You know, like all those people that always have tried to, you know, keep you back in your life. You do, I think, get to a point sometimes where it's just like, wow, I've arrived. And, you know, despite all the naysayers, what was that point for you?
You know, I think it was like, I think when once I went and I moved to Toronto and I found my group of people, I think that that was kind of my first getting out of the town I grew up in and people liking me just for who I was. You know, being gay, my fashion, like just embracing all of the things that were so kind of, you know, that people made fun of me. I think that was the first time where I found like an, I felt like I actually had a sense of community. I think maybe the time that I thought that I had arrived was after Rachel Zoe's, the first season of her show started to air. And we, you know, I was working that job as an assistant and then the show had been filmed and was on TV and it was starting to take on a life of its own. And we didn't think that it was going to be anything that anybody would ever want to watch. And I think that that was like an actual moment where I was like, oh my God, this is like more than anything I ever thought would happen to me. And I also felt at the same time that all of the things that I had done, having been through theater school and having my time that was short, but working at Vogue. And there were all of these things that fell together in that moment where I was like, oh, this is why I did all those things. This prepared me to be able to do this. And I think that's also why I've always stayed super, you know, grateful for all of the opportunities that I have been lucky to live because I dreamed about them. And I've told you this before, that I dreamed of being a part of the fashion world. So to be a part of that world and be going to shows and talking to you and meeting Oscar De La Renta and, you know, meeting Michael Kors and all of these people and Naomi Campbell. And my head was like exploding every single day because I was like, wow, the magazines are alive in my life. Like I'm a part of the fashion magazine that I was looking at and I was watching you talk about on TV. I'm like, I'm in it. I'm in the thing, you know? So I never don't get those butterflies before a show. My last trip before everything closed down, I was in Paris for Fashion Week with Demi Moore is a client of mine, and we were going to the Dior show together. And just before the show, we went backstage and we were sitting in the room with Maria Grazia before the show. And I saw, like, we walked past all the models and Maria Grazia was there talking to us. And I was like, this is insane. Like, this is so crazy. I'm the show hasn't started. I'm sitting here talking with Maria Grazia before the models walk out with Demi Moore. I was just like this is the most incredible experience, you know, to be able to live in it and appreciate it is such a gift.
And that's one of the many reasons that I love and appreciate you so much, because you never did get jaded. Like all that great stuff happened. But, listen, it's so easy. We've met a lot of people who got carried away with their own BS or just, you know, you really have always looked at the world that way with wide-eyed wonder. And I mean, that's something that I've always tried to hang on to and be like myself. I think it'd be so horrible to be jaded and take that stuff for granted. You had a chance to work with some amazingly fabulous women over the years who, you know, and I'm sure just as you imparted so much of your style sense onto them or your style knowledge, they certainly must have taught you a heck of a lot.
Oh, yeah.
The true meaning of great style. What would
totally.
You say? Some of the biggest lessons you've learned about style have been, and who did you learn them from?
You know, I think all of my clients have really, I think what each of my clients have taught me is I definitely have a thing that I'm drawn to. Like I'm so drawn to like the glamour of the 1950s and Ava Gardner and Marilyn Monroe and then moving up to like icons like Madonna for, you know, the high fashion, the Gaultier, the Gucci for Tom Ford, like all of those moments, the Galliano for Dior, like all of that I love. But I think what they've all really taught me is to really listen to and fine tune exactly what their style is. You know, I think like with Rashida Jones and Demi Moore, they've both taught me so much about how women can be sexy in, you know, like a menswear inspired blazer. And, you know, one of the things that I like a blazer or suiting, or, you know, how to find kind of hidden sensuality in things as opposed to it always having to be all out on the table. And I have clients who are like that, but I also really like the fact that we have found, they have taught me ways to be like sexy and sensual without being overtly, you know, everything out there. Yeah. And I think also just allowing people the opportunity to play. Like, we have fun in my fittings, you know. It's not, it's still dress up for me, you know. It's like everything for me came from Barbie, and it's like the ultimate like Barbie dream closet all the time, especially around award shows. I'm like, Barbie's got a really good dream closet between like January and March. You know what I mean? I think that's probably the biggest lesson for me. And I've had such an opportunity to work with and be a part of like really big life moments with a lot of my clients, which is really nice to be there and to, you know, I think another, Jenna Dewan was, I think, one of the first pregnant women. Oh, actually, no, Jessica Alba was the first. And then Jenna Dewan after that. And being able to dress women in their pregnancy while they're like, and to be a part of that for 9 months is an incredibly special thing. Like, it's really, I remember when Jessica Alba called me and said that she was pregnant, and I was like, oh my God, how are we going to keep the fashions up? How are we going to, like, you know, we're on like such a good roll, and everything kind of like exploded around her pregnancy style. Yeah, and it was just, it was like such a great experience to be able to experience that with one of my clients. It was really fun.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. That takes me back to a time when I was pregnant with my first, don't know, it was 1989. I was pregnant with my second daughter, Joey, and I was at a Karl Lagerfeld couture fitting, like, you know, on the eve of the big couture show at his studio. And I was feeling like a beached whale because all the assistants were running around the studio, you know, wearing these chic little white and black outfits. And I was there wearing like some drab olive green, you know, horrifying sandwash silk outfit from, you know, the local maternity shop in Toronto that just, it was horrifying. I just felt like a total beached whale. And actually, just before Carl came into the room, his assistant, you know, said to me, would you like to borrow something from the collection to wear for the interview with Carl? And he's like, nothing's going to fit me. Like, he says, no, come with me. And we went, it was Gilles Dufour. I don't know, you know, who actually ended up being a great designer himself. But so Gilles took me into this room that was filled with all these samples from couture shows, like just, and it was okay, so find something. I went, oh my God, if life could ever be ironic, how am I ever going to find something to fit? Like, I gained so much weight during my pregnancy. It was ridiculous. So finally, I'm looking through the racks and I see this like beautiful black crepe, white satin dress. It had this arrow going down the front of it. And it was a kind of a boxy style. And I thought the arrow going down the front of it could maybe make me look a little bit slimmer. Like, maybe I could fit into this. I don't know. And I tried it on and it actually fit.
Wow.
And I just felt like, wow, talk about the power of clothes to really transform you and elevate you. So then Carl walked in and he saw me in the dress and he goes, oh, that's a, you know, that's fabulous on you. And it was like, wow, really? Like, you like it on me? This is, you know, and then at the end of the interview, he says, oh, yes, ce sera un cadeau pour toi. Like, he gave it to me as a gift.
Wow.
Yeah, he says, you know, this is such a great look on you. I'm gifting you that dress. And it was like, rah. So it hangs in my closet still, this Chanel, you know, complete with pearl buttons. And I mean, it was a classic Chanel. It has a little black camellia at the neck. It's the most beautiful little dress. I never wore it again, though, after the pregnancy, because I don't know. It just felt like
it had its moment.
Yeah, it was a maternity dress after all.
The last person you want to have eyes on that dress is Karl Lagerfeld. Right?
Oh, that's true.
Isn't that true?
That's true too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's I mean, but wonderful. You're a real lover of women. You know, you are. You really are.
I do.
And I know I've been lucky enough to meet your mom. So, you know, and I understand how you are mad about her because she's just the most delightful, warmest, beautiful person. Yeah. Tell me about that love affair that you've had with women and how that's worked
just,
for you.
You know, I grew up with my grandmother as well. Both grandmothers. My mom's mom took care of us a lot because my mom and my dad both worked. And so we would go to my grandma's after. And my grandmother was just like a wonderful, very tough human being. And she embraced all of my kind of behavior that wasn't very acceptable, basically. You know, like I played with Barbies. I always wanted to be with her in the kitchen. I always wanted her to buy me more Barbies, which she would do, and hide from my dad and all of these things. And she really taught me to just be who I was. And my mom did too. And I just was really lucky to grow up around women. And my grandmother was very tough. So if we acted out, my sister and I, she wasn't afraid to tell us. And so I learned to respect women like very, very early on. And I also had such a deep love for my mom and my grandmothers that, you know, I'm just so lucky too that I've been able to work with so many women that I respect, but also that I'm so happy I've got to become friends with, you know? And aside from my own family, I had my sister, I had, you know, girlfriends growing up in school that all really insulated me and protected me from people that wanted to do harm to me. And I've just always been, I mean, it's made me super affectionate towards women. That's also made me, on the flip side of that, kind of afraid of guys. So I think especially straight men, but I think in my adult years, I've grown to kind of trust men a little bit more and have the same, like, be able to be open and teachable and to have a different experience than what I was used to growing up. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that came from my father, because my father is super loving and is very, very, very supportive of me and you know, my sexuality and my life. So it's not that. It's just more that when you are kind of, you learn to be afraid of, I learned to be afraid of men that I didn't know. And I think kind of undoing that has been really freeing for me, because I have a lot of really great gay male friends and also straight male friends too.
What about being a Canadian? Because by nature, I think we're just downright nicer. Do you find that maybe helped you when you entered that kind of, you know, meanish world that sometimes you encounter in the fashion arena?
1,000%, definitely. I think my Canadian-ness has served me very well, because it has. I don't know. There's just something people will always say once they find out I'm Canadian. Oh, that's why you're so nice. Or I was always wondering, well, how you could always be so nice and so calm and mm-hmm. so easy to work with. And I think that those are great things. And I like that too. When I go home, I definitely feel a sense of, and Gary will say it too, like, I forget. I there's a florist I use in my hometown when I'm sending flowers to my mom or my grandma. And every time I call and the interaction is so nice, I'm like, oh, right. I'm from like super nice people. Like I grew up around like really nice people. And, you know, I felt safe. And you know, it's nice that my mom is so sweet and my sister, like, it's just nice to be known for being, it's nice to be celebrated for being nice. And I do think, and I know you know this as well, that in our industry and in the fashion industry, even though the old kind of idea of the mean, bitchy fashion person, there are still a lot of those, I do believe that I have been welcomed into a lot of different scenarios that I wouldn't have been if I wasn't known as being a nice person in fashion. I definitely think that having a reputation for being easy to work with, being nice, and I'm just not like, I don't know. Like I said, I still have this gratitude of, and it's not imposter syndrome either. It's not like I don't feel like I belong in these places. It's just that growing up and dreaming of being there, it still doesn't, you know, it still doesn't escape me that I'm sitting at a show or I'm at like a dinner and I'm, you know, I'm such a fan of designers and actresses and actors that I'm always kind of still like, can't believe I'm where I am sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly keeps you humble and that's always a good thing. You also have a very sweet husband, a genius and cute. Gary Jannetty, who's a writer, producer, famous for things like Family Guy. I mean, and now working on a cartoon series about the royal family. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's writing an animated series for HBO Max. It's called The Prince, and it's a satire of the royal family. Starring Prince George, he plays the main character, Prince George, and it's great. It has Orlando Bloom as Harry, Frances de la Tour as the Queen, Alan Cumming as George's, butler. It's an incredible cast, and the scripts are just like outrageously hilarious.
I can't wait. But Gary's American.
Gary is. He's from Queens.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And you, the Canadian, who's, you know, I'm sure, and you do hold the royal family in esteem, right?
Ish.
Ish. Okay, that's but for yes, another podcast.
No, but it's way more a part of my life. Yeah. You know, like the royal family is, you know, we're part of the Commonwealth. So yes, I'm very much, I'm not like a royalist or anything, I'm definitely aware, aware.
What fun, and what crazy times we're all living through. Thank you so much for the conversation and just for being who you are. Just love you to bits. And
likewise.
Looking forward to giving you a big hug.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening. You can catch me Thursday evenings on TSC's Style Matters. And new episodes of Beyond Style Matters will be coming at you each and every week. Till next time, I'm Jeannie Becker.